Hey everybody, Pastor Stephen Anderson here from Faith Forward Baptist Church in Tempe, Arizona. Today I'm going to be talking about this book, The Beak of the Finch by Jonathan Weiner. And I read the book twice, cover to cover. I underlined a whole bunch of stuff. And I am just going to go through this, everything that I've underlined, and just show you how absurd and ridiculous this book is. You know, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, Evolution in the Flesh, a landmark of evolutionary studies. But this book is truly ridiculous. This presentation, I'm warning you, is not gonna be very organized because I'm just gonna start at the beginning and just read through what I've underlined and talk about it. But hang in there and I will show you just how crazy this book really is. So let me start out on page 6 of the book. It says, "The Origin of the Species says very little about the origin of species. Darwin's full title is On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Yet the book does not document the origin of a single species or a single case of natural selection or the preservation of one favored race in the struggle for life." A little bit later it says, "Darwin never saw it happen." Later it quotes Darwin on the same page, "We see nothing of these slow changes in progress until the hand of time has marked the lapse of ages." So here's what this book is doing. Basically, they're explaining that Darwin theorized evolution taking place over millions of years or even billions of years and not as something that we could observe happening because the process is so slow. This book is claiming that it's happening so fast, it's happening all around us, we can just observe it taking place in real time. The first part of the book is called Evolution in the Flesh, and it claims that actually we can see this. Listen to this quote from page 9. "Taken together, these new studies suggest that Darwin did not know the strength of his own theory. He vastly underestimated the power of natural selection. Its action is neither rare nor slow. It leads to evolution daily and hourly, all around us, and we can watch." What's so dumb about this is the reason that they think it's happening so fast and that it's just happening daily and hourly and that we can watch it happen is because what they're talking about is not evolution. So basically, they're describing animals adapting to their environment and natural selection working on animals. And they're saying, see, that's evolution happening right before our eyes. But no, it isn't. Now, if we're going to talk about natural selection, let's talk about artificial selection. Okay, artificial selection is when someone who's, say, breeding dogs or breeding horses would choose to, say, you know, breed the biggest dogs with each other so that they can make the breed get bigger and bigger, or to breed the smallest dogs with one another to make the dogs smaller and smaller. Maybe they could take a really aggressive dog and breed it with another aggressive dog and make the breed more aggressive. On and on, I could give examples of what you would do with artificial selection. You know, whether you're cultivating plants or animals, that's what you do, okay? And of course, that works. Well, here, all natural selection is, it's just that same process taking place in the wild. You know, and so natural selection is just as real as artificial selection. Obviously, yeah, natural selection is taking place every day out in the wild. Survival of the fittest is happening, and obviously these different selection pressures, whether it be a drought or a flood, any kind of a change in climate or landscape, is going to drive changes in the animals and plants due to natural selection. Of course that's happening every day. Of course that's real. Okay, or for example, let's say you're talking about germs, you know, you're talking about some kind of a bacterial infection. They always tell you to take all the antibiotics, because if you don't take all the antibiotics, what could happen is you take enough antibiotics to kill most of the bacteria, and then that little bit of bacteria that survives is the strongest bacteria, and then they multiply and you basically are creating a stronger strain of the bacteria in your body. So we see viruses mutating, we see bacteria getting stronger and more resistant to antibiotics. But the foolish thing about this book is that they're claiming that that's evolution. And they even say in this book, like, how can anyone be a creationist anymore? I mean, we see it happening everywhere. But here's the colossal difference between that and evolution is that at the end of the day, these animals adapt and natural selection works on them, but at the end of the day, they're always still the same kind of animal. Now, they might be a different species, but that's because science will take the same kind of animal and divide it up into literally like 100 species, even though it's the same kind of animal. They'll take animals that can mate with each other and produce fertile young and say that they're two different species. They'll take two animals that are virtually identical, one's brown and one's yellow, and they'll say, these are two different species because they live in different places and they, you know, they don't mate with each other. They could if they wanted to, but you know, they don't because they're so far apart. So obviously, yeah, an animal can go from species to species, but that's only because, you know, they're dividing up kinds of animals into so many species. What has never been observed, what never will be observed, what could never happen is for an animal to go from one kind of an animal to another. You're not gonna go from a cat to a dog or a dog to a cat. Yeah, you can have one kind of finch become another kind of finch, but it's still a bird. It's still even the same type of bird, okay? So there's a huge difference between animals adapting and still being the same kind of animal and what evolution is claiming. Now what is evolution claiming? Evolution is claiming that every single plant and animal on this planet came from one original life form. There's one original living thing that produced all the life that we see today, that everything is related in that sense. That's what evolution is claiming. And evolution claims that the way this has taken place over all the millions of years, they're claiming that it's through random mutations, okay? Just basically random changes in the DNA. And here's what's going on with that. You know, our bodies replicate DNA very accurately, and they have all of these safety mechanisms and fail safes and enzymes that will correct errors. But even with all that, you know, let's say approximately 1 in a billion times, there's gonna be a coding error. Now that might not sound like a lot, but it actually is a lot, because of the fact that, you know, the human genome, for example, has 2.9 billion base pairs, okay? So you have these little errors taking place, or you could also have DNA get damaged. And so random errors and damage, evolution is claiming that random errors and damage has led to mutations that were beneficial mutations, and then natural selection makes that beneficial mutation continue on, okay? Now here's the thing, what we're observing with dog breeders, that's not a random mutation. And here's the proof that it's not a random mutation, because of the fact that the results are predictable and there's an upper limit. You know, think about the big dog breeds, right? Great Danes are the big ones. Well, first of all, number one, you can't go bigger than that, okay? You can't make dogs the size of a horse. You can't make dogs the size of a house. You have an upper limit there, okay? Now, not only that, but Great Danes are not the healthiest dogs. They have problems because they are on the large end of what a dog can be. They're pushing that limit, and you can't go beyond that. Okay, and then other dogs have been bred to be very tiny, like Chihuahuas. But look at the problems that Chihuahuas have. I mean, their eyes are bulging out of their head. They're always like shaking and trembling. They have all kinds of issues because they're kind of pushing the boundary of how small a dog can get. Now, here's the thing. If these type of changes were just random, if it were just random mutations allowing you to just keep going bigger, you know, if the circumstances benefit bigger, let's go bigger, then you would be able, if it were random, then you would be able to eventually make dogs the size of houses and the size of cars, etc. You just keep going bigger. Because if nature favors a big dog, it's just gonna keep getting bigger. Well, artificial selection can do that because the breeder can choose to go bigger, bigger, bigger and feed them and take care of them and whatever, but you still can't make it get huge because there's an upper and a lower limit. Okay, so here's the thing, there's variety among dogs, but you're never gonna breed dogs until they turn into cats. You're never gonna breed dogs the size of cars. You're never gonna breed dogs that become like cows or deer or other kinds of animals, okay? Because a dog is always going to be a dog. There's a lot of variety amongst dogs, but at the end of the day, a dog is a dog, okay? So anyway, that's the basic idea here. But I want to read for you a bunch of the quotes from this book, because there's just a lot of dumb things in the book and so forth. Now, before I do, though, since we're back here on page 8, here they quote a book by a creationist. Okay, so they're quoting this guy, Dwayne Gish. I'm not familiar with him. But they quoted this guy. He says this: neither evolution nor creation can be tested as a scientific theory. So believers in evolution or creation must accept either view by faith. Now, I agree with that 100%. You know, you can't prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that biblical creation is real. You have to believe that by faith. You have to believe the Bible. Okay, and neither can you believe beyond, or excuse me, neither can you prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that, you know, evolution has caused all animals and plants that we see to come from one single ancestor. You know, you can't prove that either. So there's some faith required. And then it goes on to say this: by creation, we mean the bringing into being by a supernatural creator of the basic kinds of plants and animals by the process of sudden or fiat creation. We do not know how the creator created, what processes he used, for he used processes which are not now operating anywhere in the natural universe. Okay. And so again, I agree with that. That's true. You know, God brought into being the basic kinds of plants and animals. Obviously, they're constantly adapting and changing and altering. Yeah, random mutations are out there. But that's a far cry from claiming that there are enough beneficial mutations to go from one creature to every single plant and animal that we see today. That's absurd and ridiculous, okay? Think about it. I mean, imagine a computer program, right? Because DNA is like a programming language. Instead of zeros and ones, it has four different options. Instead of being binary, there are four different letters that could be chosen in the code. You know, imagine a computer program where you just go into a computer program that someone wrote and you just start making random changes. I mean, do you really think that the computer program is going to run better because you made some random changes? Now, if you're lucky, if you went into a really long, complicated computer program and made a couple of random changes, if you're lucky, everything will just kind of stay the same and you won't notice because you didn't screw up anything major, right? That's what's happening with us all the time. You know, we all probably have some screw ups in our DNA, but hopefully it was nothing too major and we'll be okay. But you're certainly not gonna go in and make random changes to a computer program, and now the computer program's running better. Now the computer program's getting more complicated. It's getting more complex. It's able to do more functions because I just randomly changed letters and numbers here and there. It's absurd. All right, let's keep going here. It says at the bottom of page 8, they're studying the evolutionary process not through fossils, but directly in real time, in the wild, evolution in the flesh. And again, because they're looking at something that's not evolution and claiming that it's evolution, you know. If that's evolution, then you know, cultivating plants and animals is evolution. Then dog breeders are instruments of evolution. That's ridiculous. Verse 16, they're watching evolution in the flesh and evolution in the blood. The study of evolution in action throws light on our origin and on our history. All right, chapter 2, page 17. There are 13 species of finches in the Galapagos. Some of them look so much alike during the mating season that they find it hard to tell themselves apart. Okay, so there's 13 species of finches. Remember, the finches are the big thing. That was the revelation for Darwin, right? But this book says that the 13 species of finches are so much alike, they can't even tell themselves apart. Okay, what a nothing burger. Okay, so we're supposed to be so impressed about evolution in the flesh because some birds changed into another bird that looks so similar that they can't even tell each other apart and they accidentally mate with the wrong species from time to time. Because species is just an arbitrary classification. Okay, let's go to page number 23. Every living thing is related, whether distantly or nearly, and every animal and plant shares the same ancestors at the root. So they're claiming that everything from an eggplant to a lion is all related, and they all came from the same original creature. Page 24. Okay, this is talking about a guy who doesn't believe in evolution, or didn't at the time, Linnaeus. To him and to other pious naturalists of his generation, the myriad relationships and family resemblances that Linnaeus used to bring order to nature did not represent anything like a genealogy of descent. Rather, they represented the plan of God, who created the species in a single week, as described in the first pages of the Hebrew Bible. And God created great whales and every winged fowl after his kind, and God saw that it was good. Now notice the stupid straw man where they claim that God created the species in a single week. And remember what they mean by species, my friend. They look at 13 finches that are very much alike and claim that it's 13 different species. So they're creating the straw man that says that creationists believe that, like, God created every species. I don't believe that for one second. I believe that God just created dogs, and then later they diversified into species. And by the way, on Noah's Ark, guess how many dogs there were? Two. I believe that every single dog breed today, whether it's a wolf, a coyote, all the different domestic dog breeds, Boston Terriers, Pit Bulls, whatever, they all came from two dogs on Noah's Ark. Two, okay? So to sit there and claim that we believe that God created every species exactly the way it is right now in the creation week is a straw man, because creationists don't believe that, because that would be ridiculous. Obviously, we know animals are changing over time. Obviously, we know that we can breed dogs and create new dog breeds that have never existed before by mixing different combinations. So this is a straw man, and that's why the book's even called The Origin of the Species. Because, yeah, okay, species originated by selective breeding or natural selection, so what? It's still the same kind of animal. And this is where the fraud of evolution really, you know, it comes down to this. It comes down to species versus kind. You know, they obsess over a species, which is a made-up arbitrary distinction, and we would talk about the kinds of animals, everything bringing forth after its own kind. So that's a straw man. And then it talks about on page 26, how Lyell, a scientist of the 19th century, said there are fixed limits beyond which the descendants from common parents can never deviate from a certain type. And I say amen to that. There are fixed limits, right? A dog can only get so big, it can only get so small, and so forth. There's certain limits. It's always gonna have four legs. It's always gonna have two eyes. It's not gonna evolve into a centipede or something, right? All right. So I have this marked as another straw man on page 31. There were some who thought that God created each kind of domestic animal and plant separately. They argued for every variety being an aboriginal creation. But Darwin knew from reading the breeders' treatises that the power lay with the breeders themselves. As if anyone actually believes that every single variety of domesticated animals were created that way. Obviously, we know that they have been cultivated. Man has been cultivating and selectively breeding plants and animals since the beginning of creation for thousands of years. That's not a new thing. That's not part of modern science. That's something that civilizations have done since the very beginning. And so that's a big straw man right there. All right, page number 33. These birds were so very different from one to the next, as Darwin explained to Lyell, that if they had been found in the wild, they would have been classified by biologists as belonging to separate species or separate genera, even distinct groups of species. Yet all these breeds had been created by nothing more mysterious than selection. So basically, Darwin breeded a bunch of pigeons, and then him and his scientist buddy Lyell said, man, if biologists would have found these in the wild, they would have classified into them a whole bunch of different species or even a whole bunch of different genera, the plural for genus. But they were just from the same old pigeons. It happened fast. It's just a few generations. It's because it's not evolution. That's why it can so predictably happen so fast, because it is not evolution. It's just, I mean, that's like saying, you know, if a family where everybody has brown hair has a redheaded kid, that evolution just happened or something. That's not evolution. All that's telling you is that there's some redheaded ancestor back there somewhere, and you know, that gene just got expressed. Same thing with all these other animals. Pigeons. Not that humans are animals, because of course humans aren't. But they think that humans are animals. We know that man is made in the image of God and is superior to the animals. All right, page 40. Wherever naturalists find such a blur, they should suspect that there's a place where evolution is in fast action, where species are in the act of being born. Of course, Darwin thought even this fast action would be too slow to watch. Page 41. Taxonomists can be classified into splitters and lumpers. Faced with the diversity of Darwin's finches, some splitters recognize dozens and dozens of species and subspecies. Some lumpers went so far as to call them all a single species. So all of Darwin's finches, some biologists would just say, this is one species, it's one species, it's a finch. Again, very arbitrary. Page 43, in no other birds are the differences between species so ill-defined. Can't even tell the difference between these things. And so that's Darwin's finches for you. All right, chapter 4, I'm on page 49. A watch would require more explanation than a stone. A watch, says Paley, implies a watchmaker. Someone had to invent it. Someone had to put it together. And if that is true of a watch, Paley asks, how much more so of the living things we find on the heath? Even the simplest working parts of the smallest plants and animals go so far beyond our mortal powers of artifice that they imply an artificer of artificers, a creator of creators, a god. Okay. Amen. I mean, a watch implies a watchmaker, and every single plant and animal is way, way more complicated than a watch. But if you were walking along and you saw a watch on the ground, it would be absurd to think that that came about naturally. Okay. And that's the absurdity of evolution. Also, if you dropped a watch from a high building and let it hit the ground so that it would just sustain a little bit of damage, do you think that the watch would improve its function? Or let's say you dropped it a million times. What percentage of the time would the function of the watch be improved? I would say zero. It would never work better. It'd probably work the same. Maybe it'd work differently. Maybe it'd work worse. But to actually say that dropping it enough times, eventually you'll get an improved watch, is absurd. All right, let's keep going here. Find the next thing I underlined. All right, page 79. Natural selection by itself is not evolution. It is only a mechanism that, according to Darwin, can lead to evolution. So notice what they're saying. Natural selection by itself isn't evolution. Amen. Natural selection is real. Natural selection is true. Evolution isn't. And this book, Proving Natural Selection, proves nothing about evolution. And that's why, you know, what they just said there is contradicting the whole book, because the whole book is claiming that by proving natural selection among the finches on the Galapagos, that they have somehow proved evolution, which they haven't, because those are two very different things. Okay, we're on page number 81. They saw evolution in action. Not only is Darwin's process in action among Darwin's finches, but only can natural selection, not only is Darwin's process in action among Darwin's finches, not only can natural selection lead to evolution among their flocks, but it leads there much more swiftly than Darwin supposed possible. All right, let's keep going here. We've heard that before. All right, page 96. Natural selection can be swift and sure. And then a little bit later it says this. These hard science types often remind him of how soft the science of evolution is perceived to be by the outside world, even by biologists. I was talking with someone in vision physiology the other day, and he told me, wow, I had no idea that the subject was so rigorous. I had no idea that you actually did experiments. And then this guy Endler says, we have a serious public relations problem. People don't realize that this is real science. Yet people don't think it's real science because it isn't real science. And it is a soft science. You know, other sciences are much more rigorous. They demand much higher levels of proof, and they're a lot more mathematics based. They're a lot more quantitative than just this made up fairy tale of every single animal coming from a single ancestor. The proof for that is lacking, okay? Look, an evolutionist can't even tell you what life is. They can't even tell you the definition of life or what even makes something be alive. They can't tell you where the first life form came from. And so it is a soft science indeed. All right, let's keep going. And by the way, that's why if you want to get a degree in biology, it requires the least math of any science degree. You know, other science degrees, you're taking calculus 3, modern differential equations, linear algebra, mathematical methods, for physics and all this super difficult math. Biology requires the least math pretty much of the sciences. All right, 111. The closer you look at life, the more rapid and intense the rate of evolutionary change. The farther back in time you stand, the less you see. Now, here's what they're saying. They're saying, well, when you look at it over the short term, man, changes are happening fast. But when you look at it from far away, it's really slow. That's because when you're looking at it in a short period of time, yeah, there's all kinds of genetic variation. You know, we might have kids that look a lot different than us. But if you go 500 years in the future, 500 years in the past, you know, we're all still going to kind of look similar. We're all going to look like people, you know, we're all going to look like, you know, whatever our nationality is. In a single year, you can find rates of change as high as 60,000 Darwins. That's just some weird unit of measure that they came up with that's totally meaningless. But in the fossil record, the average is only a tenth of a Darwin. The reason for the discrepancy is not far to seek. If at any time in those millions of years a species changed swiftly, but the rest of the time it changed slowly, the start and stop motion would average into a very sluggish movement. So this is what they're basically claiming. They're claiming, well, you know, evolution just goes really, really slow for a really long time, and then just like, boom, there's a quick change. Here's what they're basically explaining. They're explaining why the missing links aren't there. You know, they're explaining why you have just a ton of animals that are the same and then this big jump to another kind of animal and nothing in between. No, it's because evolution didn't happen from one kind to another. It only happens from one species to another, and one species to another is a nothing burger because species are arbitrary designations of the same kind of animal. Okay, chapter 9, page 126. Evolution happens the whole time. Evolution is always happening, completely contrary to Darwin's view that very, very slowly, very intermittently life evolves. So this book is basically even disagreeing with Darwin. Even Darwin would disagree with this book. Even evolutionists can't even agree on this, even though these are so dramatically different ideas. Does it take millions of years, or does it happen super fast so we can watch it? Which one is it? Geneticists will tell you that evolution is always happening. What they mean is that the genes of this generation are not precisely what they were the preceding generation. Yeah, so my kids are not going to be clones of me and my wife. Wow, I'm shocked. Nor will they be precisely the same in the next. And evolution is that change. That's not evolution, okay? My kids looking a little different than me doesn't mean that every animal and plant on this planet came from a single ancestor, okay? That's a huge logical leap. And it's almost a certainty, a mathematical certainty, that the genes will never be the same. Again, totally meaningless. All right, page number 128. What makes a new species? How exactly does variation lead to creation? It is one thing to demonstrate, as the Grants have done, that natural selection leads to evolution. It is another and much more complicated thing to demonstrate precisely how this evolution leads to a new species. And despite the title of his greatest book, Darwin himself never spells out the details. Darwin calls the origin one long argument. And this is the step in the argument that many of his readers find the hardest to follow. The step that feels like a leap of faith from slight individual differences in one nest or one seedbed or one family album to the striking differences between species. But they should say the striking differences between kinds. a little later on page 129. They cannot believe that the process can create something new. That's because the process cannot create something new. It has never been observed to create something new. It's just bringing out genes that were already there. Dogs have all these genes that are already there, all these different options, all these different directions they can go when you breed them. But there are limits because it's not new things that are being created. There's nothing new under the sun. Page 165. I look at the term species, this is quoting Darwin, I look at the term species as one arbitrarily given for the sake of convenience to a set of individuals closely resembling each other. And yeah, that's the way I look at it too, Darwin. And then it says on page 165, most of the finches on the island seldom interbreed. Well, guess what? That means that they do interbreed if they seldom do it. Most of them seldom do. That means a few of them do often. Most seldom, some often. Because they're all the same kind of animal. 166, the word species comes from the Latin verb specere, to see. Linnaeus used the word to mean groups of animals and plants that look distinctly different to the eye. Okay, so if we applied that to human beings, because these people claim that animals or that people are animals, then okay, do black people look different than Japanese people? I guess according to them, it'd be two different species, right? It's ridiculous, it's absurd. And by the way, if a black person and a white person get married and they have a child, let's say Obama, right? And then if Obama marries a black girl and then has kids, those kids are gonna look black. And if they marry black people, after a few generations, you would completely forget that they ever had a white great-grandma, because Obama's mom is white as snow. But if they keep marrying black people, you'd forget that they had that white ancestor. Or if Obama would have married a white person and then their kids would have married a white person, a couple generations, you'd forget that a black person was ever in that lineage. Why? Because humans are not a bunch of different species. We're all just humans, right? We're all men made in the image of God. And it's these other animals, it's the exact same thing. You know, just because they look different doesn't mean that they're a different kind of animal. When the Grants saw, page 176, was the population cinching at the waist like an amoeba in the act of dividing, and the division was just a millimeter in the bird's beaks. Wow, what a big deal. The beak got a millimeter shorter. Okay, 177. The intervals between the horizontal lines in the diagram may represent each 1,000 generations, Darwin writes, but it would have been better if each had represented 10,000 generations. So Darwin's just claiming, you know, evolution's just gonna take tens of thousands of generations, millions of years, billions of years. And this book is saying he's wrong, man. It's happening fast. It's just rapid. Okay, 178. What has already emerged from these studies is how fast divergence can happen, how much we can actually see in real time. We're not talking about the lapse of ages here. Page 180. No one has ever put this problem more forcefully than Darwin himself in The Origin. This is quoting Darwin. To suppose that the Eve, with all its inimitable contrivances for... Oh, I'm sorry. I underlined it, so I crossed out part of the word, so I misread it. Let me start over. To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. So Darwin is saying, thinking that the eye actually evolved through natural selection is absurd in the highest. He said, I confess, it seems to be absurd in the highest degree. You know, I agree with you, Darwin. That is absurd in the highest degree. Okay, page 181. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ, you know, like the eye, existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Now, here's what's just the craziest thing in this whole book, Beak of the Finch. They claim that the example of the organ that Darwin was looking for is the cross-billed beak. This is the beak where the top and the bottom don't line up properly. So it's like a jagged edge thing, right? And so they create this straw man, like, well, Darwin said if any complicated organ existed that couldn't come about through natural selection, his theory would fall apart. Well, that'd be like the cross-billed beak. But look, we figured out that the cross-billed beak did arise slowly in stages. You know, it just kept getting that overbite or whatever. Folks, does anyone actually think that a cross-billed beak is super complicated? It's like, oh, wow. The beak, instead of going like this, it goes like this. Oh, wow. You know, I've seen all kinds of people with crooked teeth. In fact, every time I look in the mirror. But that's just absurd to claim that that's what Darwin was talking about. When Darwin said something that's just so complicated that it couldn't come from natural selection, he used the eye as an example. But it turns out everything's way more complicated than Darwin thought, because he didn't know about DNA. He did not know about what was going on at the cellular level, because this is 1859 when his book Origin of the Species came out. See, Darwin was actually contemporary with Gregor Mendel, the father of modern genetics. And Gregor Mendel's work was not even famous at the time. After Mendel's death in the early 20th century, his work was rediscovered with the discovery of DNA and everything. It got popular, and posthumously, Gregor Mendel's work became super important in science, but not in his lifetime. So Darwin would not have been familiar with it, and Mendel knew nothing about DNA. He was just barely beginning to scratch the surface of genetics, okay? Darwin knew nothing about DNA or anything super complicated on the cellular level, because it hadn't been discovered yet. So he looks at it, Darwin looks at a single-celled organism, and to him, it's not complicated. Now we know that a single-celled organism is extremely complicated, and that any single-celled organism is one of those things. I mean, look, he says right here, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. That's every single-celled organism. Every single cell is too complicated to have evolved by means of random changes in natural selection. Every cell in your body, every cell in every plant, every single-celled organism, every cell in every animal, plant, or human. Okay. He didn't know that. But this book just creates this straw man of the cross-billed beak. It would be the kind of problem before which Darwin felt his theory would absolutely break down. No, it wouldn't. It's not complicated at all. It's the dumbest straw man I've ever heard. Page 188. Connell's idea about competition past is related to the more general idea that evolution took place a long time ago, that it is history. Whereas in fact, natural selection is out there, Dolph says with that same mellow laughter in his voice. One can actually see it happen within the time of a PhD thesis. People never tried to look. They thought you'd have to watch a population 1,000 years, but that's what's changing now. I mean, does this guy even understand what evolution even teaches? Unbelievable. Okay, page 195. The clear sexual isolation and the maintenance of their separate identities in nature warrants calling each of them a separate species. Tironi has some bright yellow markings, whereas Neohumeralis is plain dull brown. Okay, so what if we find a human that's brown and a human that's yellow? You know, is that two different species? So is a Japanese person and a black person, are they two different species? I mean, and when you talk about sexual isolation, you know, Japan was isolated from the rest of the world for centuries. You know, they had very few people coming and going. They were closed off to the outside world for a long time. And even now, they are one of the more xenophobic, closed off countries. And so for a very long time, they did their own thing. And look, Japanese people look distinctly different from, say, white people or black people or whatever. But they're not different species. We're all human. The Bible says we're all of one blood. But I guess according to these evolutionists, you know, all the different races are just different stages of evolution. You know, it's just different. We're all different species. According to this logic, that's why it's a dangerous logic. This would teach that red, yellow, black, and white are different species. And that would mean that some are more evolved than others. That's a racist doctrine. That's a garbage doctrine. So how about that? But yet all the people who want to accuse everyone of being a racist and constantly accuse Christians of being racist, they're the real racist if they believe in this stuff. And then they admit on page 195 that every once in a while a pair of them gets together anyway. Well, every once in a while a Japanese person marries somebody who's not Japanese. All right, page 198. The total number of bird species in the world is almost 10,000. Almost 1,000 of them, the Grants write, are known to have bred in nature with another species and produced hybrid offspring, roughly one out of every 10 species. Why? Because they're all the same kind of animal, that's why. Okay, it says, of the 161 species of ducks and geese in the world, 67 species have been known to hybridize. In other words, the Grants note, almost one out of every two species of ducks and geese has been seen to interbreed in the wild. The actual incidence is likely to be much higher. Yeah, that's because it's just a kind, there's one kind of animal, duck. There's another kind of animal, goose, okay? Page 199, not so long ago, hybridization among birds was thought to be very rare. Okay, so what? People were wrong. Give it up, let it go. It's not true. Page 240, there is no difference between the largest Fortis and the smallest Magna rostris. Again, those are finches on the Galapagos, and they're pretty much the same exact bird. The speed with which these finches have adapted is amazing, and it shows how fast the primo-progenitors of Darwin's finches may have adapted when they first came to the Galapagos. Page 251. Some of the greatest opposition to evolution comes from the farmers of the Cotton Belt, and that is where Taylor is seeing one of the most dramatic cases of evolution in action on this planet. So they're mocking farmers in the American heartland for not believing in evolution, for believing in the Word of God, because, you know, they're watching crops become resistant to pesticides. And again, this goes back to my illustration earlier about, you know, bacteria becoming resistant to antibiotics. Survival of the fittest. That all that is, again, is just cultivation. Whether it's natural selection, artificial selection, yeah, the strong survive. So what? At the end of the day, that pest is still the same. Those bugs that the farmers are dealing with that have become resistant to pesticides, they're still a bug. They're still an insect, and I'm not going to rehash that again. And then it says in page 255, and that cotton growers are having to deal with these pests in the very states whose legislatures are so hostile to the theory of evolution, because it is evolution itself they are struggling against in their fields each season. These people are trying to ban the teaching of evolution, while their own cotton crops are failing because of evolution. How can you be a creationist farmer anymore? Heliothis can evolve resistance to pyrethroids in the course of a single growing season. Well, if it's so predictable that it just happens in a single growing season, like clockwork, that's because it's not random. That's because it's not evolution. It's just selection. It's just survival of the fittest, but that's not evolution, because evolution is teaching that random changes lead to beneficial mutations that are then selected naturally. Page 257, even people who think they understand Darwin tend not to think about this because they are schooled in Darwin's gradualism, you know, because again, they think it just happens super fast. I mean, at least Darwin was smart enough to realize, yeah, nobody can see this happening. It must take millions of years, because I don't see it happening anywhere. It must be millions of years. These people are so foolish, they actually think that it's happening super fast. I mean, even Darwin would have to facepalm at their stupidity. Okay, page 267. The idea that organisms evolve was transformed during the last century from conjecture to fact. As the present century draws to a close, we're experiencing another transformation. The conjecture that the world's temperature is gradually rising has become widely accepted as a demonstrated fact. So they're saying, you know, yeah, it's sort of like global warming. You know, the science is settled. Shut up and believe it because I said so. Okay, page 271. On the other hand, it might not take Darwin's process very long to separate the birds again. To turn a group of Fuliginosa into a Fortis or a Fortis into a Magna rostris, Trevor Price has calculated it would take about 20 selection events, as intense as the drought of 1977, to turn a Fortis into a Magna rostris. It's so incredibly predictable because it's not random, because it's not evolution, because it's just different genes being expressed, just like when you breed dogs. 273. Before the Industrial Revolution, the black form of the moth was under strong negative selection pressure, and the mutation stayed rare, except in forests with mostly black bark trees. And this is that famous example where the moths, when the trees turn black, the black moths became more prevalent, and when the trees were white, the white moths were prevalent. But again, even when the white moths were most prevalent, there were still some black ones. And even when the black was the most prevalent, there were still some white ones. So nothing new was created. It's not a random mutation. The black and white varieties always existed. One of them just got more popular. And so that's a self-defeating argument right there. Page 274, at present rates, Carbonaria, the black one, will be as rare as it was before the Industrial Revolution by about the year 2010. So it goes back and forth. Sometimes the white is more prevalent, sometimes the black. So what? They've always been white and black. Some genetic engineers go so far as to call their work the generation of diversity, God. So these scientists who are studying this stuff are so blasphemous that they call their work by the acronym God. G-O-D, Generation of Diversity. And by the way, let me say this. This book quotes the Bible literally like 50 to 60 times. Every chapter starts practically with a quote from the Bible because they just have it in for God. They're anti-Bible. They hate the Lord. That's why they dream this up, because the Bible says the fool has said in his heart there is no God. Page 281. But anatomically, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, and humans are as closely related as Darwin's finches. Folks, you can't make how stupid this is up. Did you hear what that just said? Anatomically, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, and humans are as closely related as Darwin's finches. Do you remember a few pages ago when they said it would take about 20 selection events to turn one breed of Darwin's finches into the other breed of Darwin's finches? Okay. Well, they're saying anatomically, chimpanzees, orangutans, and humans are as closely related as Darwin's finches. Okay, if that's true, then it should take 20 selection events to turn a human into a gorilla. Or it should take 20 selection events to turn a gorilla into a human. Isn't it funny how they can't do that? They can change a fortis into a magnarostris. They can change fuliginosa into a fortis. But they cannot change a human into a chimpanzee or a chimpanzee into a human, because this is the dumbest statement. How can this Pulitzer Prize winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize saying that humans are as close to chimpanzees, orangutans as Darwin's finches are to one another anatomically? They say, well, it didn't say their brain. Okay, then make me, then in 20 selection events, we should be able to make an animal that looks like a human but has the brain of a chimpanzee, or that looks like a chimpanzee with the brain of a human. Folks, this is absurd. How can this even get published? Where was the editor on this sentence? It's absurdity. Chimpanzees appear to be our closest living relatives. Speak for yourself. By current estimates, 99 out of every 100 genes are identical. Yeah, that's because we have two eyes, a nose, a mouth, two ears, hands, feet. But you know what? That 1% difference is a hell of a difference. And no, you can't go back and forth between humans and chimpanzees. All right, page 281. Our gift of consciousness is a mystery, one of the greatest remaining mysteries in biology. But it's no more of a miracle than a beak, a weather. You just said you don't know what it is. You just said it's a mystery.
Well, but it's not a miracle, though. It's no big deal. It's just like a beak or a feather. No big deal. Nothing to see.
You just said you don't know what it is. Consciousness is a mystery. But it's not a miracle, though. How do you know if you don't know what it is? How can you declare that it's not a miracle? How can you declare it's not supernatural when you just said you don't know what it is, that it's a mystery to you? If it's a mystery to you, then quit talking about it. Then don't make these unequivocal statements about it if you don't understand it.
It is made by the same modeling and molding of the same living clay through the same process, Darwin's.
So consciousness comes about by Darwin's process, but we don't know what it is. We don't know where it came from. But one thing we know is it didn't come from God. It came from Darwin. It's a process. Folks, this is absurd. Okay, wait till you hear this. Okay, page 281. One of the gifts of our heightened consciousness is the ability to make new tools. You have proof for that? They're claiming that consciousness gives us the ability to make tools. That doesn't follow. There's no proof for that. But here's where they're going with this. Page 283. Language became a tool that allowed us to teach not only each other, but even ourselves, after we found a new use for the opposable thumb and fingers. When you write, says Annie Dillard in The Writing Life,
You lay out a line of words. The line of words is a miner's pick, a woodcarver's gouge, a surgeon's probe. You wield it, and it digs a path you follow.
So here's basically what they're saying. They're saying that language is a tool. And then they'll say animals use tools. So basically they find an animal, like let's say an ape or something, picks up a rock and he's breaking stuff with rock. Breaking things with the rock. And they're like, see, ape used tools. And they're like, our language is just another tool. You know, there's a little bit of a difference between human language and all of its complexity. You know, let's go back to the most ancient European literature, the Iliad and the Odyssey, or let's go back to ancient literature from the Middle East. And, you know, it's a little more complicated than smashing a rock against a nut to crack a nut open, right? It's a little bit more complicated than smashing a rock into a coconut. I think that, you know, human language is way more complicated than that. And by the way, the most ancient human languages are the most complicated. They're more complicated than today's languages, which doesn't even make sense from an evolutionary perspective. Because if evolution were true, then the oldest languages would be like ooga booga, kind of me go there type language, Tarzan language. But yet ancient language is more complicated than today's language because people started out being just as smart as they are now. And that's why they had a complicated language. But to say that language is just a tool and then talk about a chimpanzee using a rock as a tool, it's absurd. All right, let's see here. Okay, here we go, page 288. Man varies from man more than animal from animal of different species. Okay, well then according to that, humans are a whole bunch of different species and that's a racist idea, as I said earlier. Page 284. That, of course, is why our own kind is not radiating into new species. For us, the whole planet now is almost as small as Cocos is for the Cocos Finch. Yeah, except that's only right now. Throughout history, there have been isolated groups, like Japan, for example, and yet it's not a different species. We're all human. Okay, page number, almost, oh, now I'm into the epilogue. Okay. Let's just skip the epilogue. Well, no, we better not skip it. I'm just afraid my phone's going to run out of power here. But let's see here. Page 295. I'm just going to drive it till the wheels fall off. Okay, this year, a poll will show that nearly half the citizens of the United States do not believe in evolution. Instead, they believe that life was created by God in something like its present form within the past 10,000 years. Amen. People talk about creationism, says Dolph Schluter. We can actually see creation at work. We might ask the creationists to demonstrate similar principles at work. Hey, dipstick, we don't believe creation is at work. We believe creation happened once in the past and it's over. And no, you're not watching creationism at work, creation at work, because you're not seeing anything new created. There were white moths and black moths. The whites took over, the blacks took over. Nothing new was created, Dolph. They have the appearance of closed minds, Peter Grant says. John Endler, the guppy watcher, does not like talking with creationists either. I avoid it, he says. It's really a waste of time. I've done exactly the same thing and never let on it was evolution and got the exact same response. Because they say, well, when we talk about our work and we don't call it evolution, people like it. And then as soon as we say it's evolution, they freak out. That's because your work isn't evolution, and that's why people freak out. Okay, page 301. Biochemists can now make primitive self-replicating molecules in computer models and synthesize them in the laboratory. Here and there, now and then, a few of them begin to make the kinds of connections that, again, if favored, if selected, generation after generation would bring them to life. Total baloney. No life has ever been created in the laboratory. Nothing close to life has been created in the laboratory. No self-replicating system has been created in the laboratory. This is just a total bold-faced lie. That's why there's no footnote. There's no study. Because if you go and look up the actual studies where they try to do this stuff, they are not even to first base. And the, you know, all this junk of, oh, we made a complex molecule. Not even close to the complexity that life requires. Not even in the same order of magnitude. Page 301, but in the ocean, of course, as fast as molecules make their first gestures toward life, they're devoured.
Creation in the sea has never stopped, but the niche of life is taken.
Again, they're just making this up. They're claiming that life is originating in the sea and that it just dies too fast. Really? Have you ever observed that? No. They make up things. And by the way, there's no evidence of it happening on another planet either, or on Earth. So okay, that's the last thing I've underlined. But do you like how they claim this? I'm going to read that one more time.
In the ocean, of course, as fast as molecules make their first gestures toward life, they're devoured. Creation in the sea has never stopped, but the niche of life is taken.
So they're claiming that in the sea right now, in the ocean right now, molecules start to make the first step toward life, and then a big fish just goes like, and just eats it. Really? Do you have any evidence for that? You have any proof? You ever demonstrated that? You ever observed that?
No.
And so anyway, I know that was just a little bit all over the place, but I hope you enjoyed it. That's my review of Beak of the Finch. It's absurd. Even if an evolutionist reads this book, they should be facepalming. I mean, I'm surprised that evolutionists aren't coming out and condemning this book as stupidity, since it even contradicts everything that Darwin taught. Okay? This is garbage. But you know what it proved? The fact that evolutionists are buying into this book, even though it contradicts everything they've taught in the past and contradicts what Darwin taught, it just shows that if you're for, as long as you're for evolution and against God, as long as you're mocking the word of God and mocking creation, you can pretty much publish whatever stupidity you want and people are going to like it. People just eat this up with fork and spoon, even though even evolutionists should be debunking this. Because even someone who actually studies evolution should be able to know the difference between the claims that evolution is making versus these type of adaptations where, you know, you're breeding dogs into different dog breeds or speciation of the finches or whatever. That it's not evolution. Okay. Is it natural selection? Yeah. And look, you know, natural selection is real. I mean, was Darwin right about natural selection taking place? Of course, but he was wrong that it could lead to new kinds of animals. He was wrong that it could produce all the life that we see. No, God created the basic kinds of animals, and then natural selection has worked on those kinds of animals so that they've adapted and changed, and you've got people that are darker and lighter, you've got animals that are bigger and smaller, you've got plants that can handle a wet climate or a dry climate, and they adapted. But at the end of the day, they're still the same kind, and there's not one shred of evidence. Folks, believe me, I have sat and listened to hours of evolutionists supposedly giving evidence for evolution. The only evidence they ever give is this kind of stuff. Just one species turning into a different species. But they're like almost the exact same kind of animal. And so, and then in the fossil record, you have these big jumps. You know, these big jumps. That's where evolution happened really fast. No. That's just two different kinds of animals, what that is. Anyway, I hope this was helpful to you. I hope you enjoyed it. God bless. Have a great day.